Nuclear legacy. How do we learn about our shared nuclear past? When the first atomic bomb explosion, the Trinity test, happened on July 16, 1945 in New Mexico, it was kept top secret and no one was informed. As a result, the cloud of radioactive fallout that it created contaminated people living downwind of it. But even after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, nothing was said about it. The story continued to be hidden and denied for years. Only in 2010 did the first ever article appear about the radiation release from Trinity and what it did to the people downwind. So when an award-winning TV producer who lives in New Mexico first learns about Trinity, and she realizes
nobody knew anything about Trinity, and it was the biggest nuclear exposure and disaster that had happened. It was bigger than Chernobyl. And people at Chernobyl were cared for, but nobody has ever been cared for that's a resident of New Mexico.
Well, when Lois Lipman, an award and Peabody-winning producer for 60 Minutes, first heard about the Trinity test, all her instincts told her that this was a story that she had to tell. And the resulting film, First We Bombed New Mexico, clearly spells out how far back our current and ongoing problems with nuclear began, and that means that you can now clearly see how not just the Trinity downwinders, but all of us, are trapped in that awful, deadly, dangerous seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine, keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we talk with journalist and filmmaker Lois Lipman about her award-winning film, First We Bombed New Mexico. It exposes the plight of the downwinders of the Trinity bomb test in 1945 and their ongoing struggle to gain recognition and compensation from the U.S. government for what is now five generations of health and environmental damage that resulted. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, Numbnuts of the Week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, and more honest nuclear information than was reported on all of mainstream media in the past week. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, August 27, 2024, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective, starting out with a breaking story that we hope will not become nuclear. In Japan, the Shanshan hurricane is bearing down on the southern part of that island nation, putting three separate nuclear facilities at risk. The hurricane is currently rated as Category 3, with gusts of wind up to 115 miles per hour. In its projected pathway are three nuclear facilities: Sendai, which has two reactors operating at full capacity; Genkai, with all four reactors operating at full capacity; and Ikata, where one of its three nuclear reactors is in full operation. Japan has issued emergency warnings for storms and high waves in Kagoshima Prefecture. They are the highest category of warnings possible in Japan and are usually only issued once every few decades, this according to the Japan Meteorological Agency. The storm is projected to continue into the north of the country, and hopefully by next week, Nuclear Hot Seat will not have any negative updates on what has happened to nuclear reactors there. In other news, Scientists in Russia's Primorsky Krai region, adjacent to the waters of the Sea of Japan, have detected increased levels of tritium in seawater following the release of radioactive tritium-contaminated water from the wrecked remains of Japan's Fukushima nuclear power plant. This finding was reported by the Pacific Oceanological Institute of the Far Eastern Branch of the Russian Academy of Sciences this past Monday. Tokyo Electric Power Company, which operates what's left of the Fukushima nuclear power plant, began releasing the radioactive tritium-contaminated water into the ocean in August of 2023. While the water is treated with a process known as Advanced Liquid Processing System, or ALPS, it does not remove radioactive tritium. In the war between Russia and Ukraine, Ukrainian forces have advanced to positions some 30 kilometers or 18 and a half miles away from the Kursk nuclear power plant, which puts it technically within artillery range. There are 6 reactors on site, and 2, which are operational now, are of the so-called RMBK design, such as the one involved in the Chernobyl disaster. Professor Stephen Starr, a previous interviewee on Nuclear Hot Seat, warns that the Kursk nuclear power plant reactors are not protected with a concrete dome. The reactors and spent fuel pools, which sit next to the reactors, are exposed and vulnerable to direct attack. A spent fuel pool fire can release enough radiation to seriously contaminate thousands of square kilometers. If nothing else, the Ukraine war has shown the world that nuclear power plants become targets in a war as pre-positioned radiological targets of opportunity. Here in the United States, in Arizona, on July 30th, Energy Fuels Incorporated started hauling uranium ore from their Pinyon Plain mine, which was previously known as Canyon Mine, to the White Mesa Mill for processing. This, despite the fact that Navajo Nation, through which this ore would be hauled, does not allow for the hauling of uranium ore through its territory. On August 24th, a small dedicated group of community members, along with their supporters, organized and deployed a spontaneous rally and march in opposition to that decision and was successful in shutting it down, with only one truck getting through. Energy Fuels plans to send out at least 6 trucks a day with the capacity to haul 30 tons of radioactive uranium ore in trucks covered only by a tarp, which means that radioactive dust can be spread in their wake. At risk will be communities in northern Arizona, southern Utah, as well as Ute Mountain Ute, Navajo, and Hopi indigenous communities. For now, the hauling of the uranium ore has been halted. In New Mexico, near Los Alamos, after 3 cleanups, independent analysis shows that 80-year-old plutonium persists in Acid Canyon, a popular hiking trail just off Los Alamos. These findings were announced by Michael Ketterer, Professor Emeritus of Chemistry and Biochemistry at Northern Arizona University. Ketterer collected and analyzed soil, water, and plant samples in Acid Canyon, a popular hiking area in the middle of town. Beginning in 1943, the year the Manhattan Project came to Los Alamos, workers released radioactive waste into the canyon. It's still there, still dangerous, and according to Dr. Ketterer, is, quote, a super weapons-grade plutonium. Professor Ketterer believes his findings prove unequivocally that legacy plutonium from Los Alamos National Laboratory has not only remained in Acid Canyon all these years later, but also migrated beyond, even after the cleanups. Quote, it's just a ribbon of contamination going down to the Rio Grande, he said. The Pentagon has pinned the cost of refurbishing the United States land-based nuclear missiles at $141 billion, a $30 billion rise from January's estimate. The Congressional Budget Office estimates that an overall modernization of the ICBM missiles will cost at least $1.5 trillion during the course of the next 30 years. Our tax dollars at work. And now,
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Num Nuts of the Week.
When Democrats finally put a spotlight on climate change before Kamala Harris's acceptance speech at the Democratic National Convention last week, Interior Secretary Deb Haaland thanked the vice president for breaking a tie vote to pass, quote, the most ambitious climate action plan, end quote, in the nation's history. But what about other existential threats like, oh, I don't know, nuclear? The Dems' 2024 party platform, approved on the first night of the convention, claims that the Biden administration, quote, is showing what it means to act responsibly as a nuclear power, end quote. But nuclear weapons were scarcely mentioned during the United Center speeches, if at all. And there didn't appear to be any nukes on the agenda during the Democrats' Chicago residency. An announced panel discussion on the topic, the latest on climate change, didn't happen because no one was there. The speakers hadn't shown up, and neither had the audience. The only nuclear reference was in a pop-up art exhibit a few blocks away from the United Center. The show, entitled Into Action 2024, with an exclamation point in action instead of an I, was a collaboration between the group's task force and drive agency. One of the biggest installations was a 10-foot-tall sculpture of a mushroom cloud, with thousands of screws drilled into it to approximate the number of nuclear warheads still in existence. In other words, how many nukes are screwing us? Asked whether it was alarming that the topic of nukes didn't appear to come up much at the convention, a Chicago content creator named Michaela Sharp said, "This would probably ruin the mood that's over there at the convention center. It really doesn't seem like this and Lil Jon would go hand in hand." And that's why, Democratic National Convention, and all you Dems who might be listening, you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, none that's out of the week.
We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, each week, the nuclear industry provides us with new nightmares and new revelations of old nightmares. But you couldn't tell any of it was happening if all you follow is mainstream media. That is why Nuclear Hot Seat exists, to give someone as caring, compassionate, aware, and concerned as you a regular weekly dose of nuclear news you can count on to be honest and vetted. Nuclear Hot Seat is the longest-running program that focuses exclusively on nuclear issues. We're now in our 14th year as a podcast and 9th year as a broadcast through Pacifica. So we have a long history of scooping mainstream media on nuclear issues, giving context and continuity to local, national, and international stories. And in addition, we work behind the scenes, providing links and introductions between activists, researchers, and reporters, so that the honest nuclear story gets out far beyond this show. That's why you can count on Nuclear Hot Seat to provide you with verifiable, fresh information and an unrelenting perspective every week. But in order to keep doing this work, let's face it, we need your help. This show runs on donations, and lately we've been coming up short, so we need your support. How about sending us $5? The same as you might expect to spend here in the U.S. for a nice cup of coffee and a tip. Or buy Nuclear Hot Seat a cup of coffee a month with a recurring donation of $5. And of course, be it one time or ongoing, any amount of donation, no top limits, all of it counts towards us hitting our monthly nut. We are a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that your donations are tax deductible. So help us out, won't you please? Just go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the red donate button. On Zelle, you can send money directly to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Don't wait. Go to nuclearhotseat.com to donate right now and know that whatever you can do to help, I'm deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now, here's this week's featured interview. It's always difficult to gain a perspective on our shared nuclear legacy. And often it takes a film made by a passionate filmmaker to give us the full story in a context we can understand. Lois Lipman is such a filmmaker. She was based in London for many years, where she researched, developed, and field-produced films for CBS News 60 Minutes worldwide, winning numerous awards including an Emmy and a Peabody. She also worked internationally for the BBC, Channel 4 UK, and PBS. Now she lives in New Mexico, and almost by accident discovered the untold story of the Downwinders, those people who were hit by radioactive fallout from the Trinity atomic bomb test in 1945, and their struggle for recognition and compensation from the U.S. government, most recently through their efforts on behalf of the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act. Now Lois's film, First We Bombed New Mexico, is out and tearing it up on the film festival trail, winning awards and moving audiences to standing ovations as they learn directly from Trinity survivors and activists such as Tina Cordova of the Tularosa Basin Downwinders the exact nature of what has been happening through what is now 5 generations and almost 80 years. I spoke with Lois Lipman on August 23, 2024, when her film was in the middle of being screened at the Oppenheimer Film Festival in Los Alamos, New Mexico. Lois Lipman, it is so great to finally have you here with us on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Libby, I love your program, and I really value the way you follow so many important voices that otherwise would not be heard. Thank you. I'm really honored to be here.
You have also been promoting and putting forth some voices that have not been heard, specifically in your film, First We Bombed New Mexico. Let's start out with a little bit about you so we know the framework for this. What is your background as a filmmaker?
First, I was a radio news reporter and did documentaries for 3 years. And then I moved to London and I got a job at 60 Minutes. And I developed stories for 60 Minutes for 7 years all over the world and won a lot of awards for my stories. A strength I have is finding voices that make you want to sit up and listen and care. I stayed in London for 12 years working in documentaries and in extended news programs.
Do you have any previous films that you have released, or is this the first one?
This is my first feature film.
And aren't we lucky to have gotten you for it?
It's a story that's worth sinking your teeth in. It's a story that's really a privilege to be able to explore something so incredibly important.
What drew you to the subject of the Downwinders in New Mexico? How did you find out about them? And what was your first impulse towards making a film?
So I didn't know the story. I'd lived in New Mexico and I had a little place there. And I moved back there to take a year off.
What year did you move back to New Mexico?
I moved back to New Mexico around 2012, I believe.
And how did you first hear about or start learning about the Downwinders?
The story really wasn't known, wasn't told. I didn't have a clue about it. Although when I worked for 60 Minutes, one of my jobs, when everybody's job, was to find significant stories that haven't been told that will teach people about their own lives and to live better lives. And so I was always hungry looking for a significant story, and it got into my DNA, I think. But I was sitting at a restaurant at the bar, having a meal at a restaurant in Santa Fe. And I started chatting with the guy who was sitting next to me. And, you know, what do you do? What do you do? Well, I'm volunteering at the community college, and we're trying to make a documentary about the Downwinders, the Trinity Downwinders. And I went, what? And he said, you know, people who were radiated by, well, he didn't say Oppenheimer's Trinity bomb, but that is what I say now. And so I was like all ears. I just couldn't believe this. It's so interesting. One reason I fell in love with New Mexico, in addition to it being so incredibly beautiful and not overexposed and overdeveloped, is that it has these three cultures. And it seemed that they all are able to live full lives. And that's Anglo-Hispanic and Native American. And what I didn't realize, that they were dying. They've been dying for so long, and nobody's helped them or had told the story. So I found out who was leading this team that was trying to make a documentary. It turned out it was a journalist. His name is Dennis Carroll. And in 2010, Dennis Carroll broke the first ever story about the radiation impact and catastrophic damage of the Trinity bomb. That is 65 years after the Trinity bomb. I mean, that's just horrific. It's unbelievable, right? That nothing that had been written about it or released about it since the detonation in 1945. So there was the CDC did a study because people, for example, in Los Alamos were really, really worried about radiation and cancer living in Los Alamos. And so they should be. And also the native communities near Los Alamos. And they were able to get a big grant to finally get the release of top secret documents about radiation in New Mexico, documents that were written by and held by the labs, the nuclear labs in New Mexico, the scientists, and the military. And it took 10 years to write the study, and it was independent top scientists who collected and interpreted the hundreds of thousands of pages and wrote this 650-word report. And yes, there is radiation exposure in Los Alamos, but the elephant in the living room was Trinity. Nobody knew anything about Trinity. And it was the biggest nuclear exposure and disaster that had happened. It was bigger than Chernobyl. And people at Chernobyl were cared for, but nobody has ever been cared for that's a resident of New Mexico. So Dennis wrote this story, and it was published in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and it took up the entire front page of the paper. And it got picked up a little bit. And then Dennis was like, well, this isn't enough. I have to make a documentary film. But he didn't have the money. He didn't have the background. And so a lot of people, a photographer at the paper, Natalie Guillen and Dennis started working on it. Then I said, please, I want to help you. I have all this experience. And so Dennis and I were driving around finding first ever eyewitnesses of the Trinity bomb that had never been recorded, their stories in Tularosa. And I feel that that is so incredibly important because it's really easy when you see all these cancers for the government or whoever to just say, deny, deny that it has that, you just had bad luck. But when you start seeing the eyewitnesses, hearing their stories, and then you go through their multi-generational families, and everybody's dying of cancer through to today, they're dying of cancer. Then it's harder to deny, much, much harder. So those eyewitnesses were critical. But anyway, at a certain point, everybody dropped out because it costs a lot of money to make a film and dedication. If you're not funded, people had to have a livelihood. And so in the end, nobody was making the film. The film was dropped by all the volunteers who were so passionate about making the film. And at a certain point, I just said, I can't live with myself. That was about 8 years ago. I made promises to the downwinders, to these people, to so many people in Tularosa, Carrizosa, who opened up their doors, fed me, told me their stories, and begged me to make the film. And I promised I would.
With this determination of yours that you were going to honor these people and the stories they had been sharing with you, how did you get started actually making the film?
There were two things that were going on at the same time. I was going to the area and doing research, hearing stories, meeting people, and collecting stories because I didn't know how I was going to tell the story. When thousands of people have died, and I wanted to make an intimate film that would impact people. And I wasn't quite sure how to do that. And then Dennis and Natalie and the community college, and I was involved. We filmed certain critical moments, like in 2015, 2016, whatever the dates were. It was the first ever times that US Congress people came to New Mexico and heard stories. So I knew, or we all knew, that these needed to be recorded. And they weren't necessarily recorded on great cameras or done that well, but we had a record of Senator Lujan making a promise to the people when he came around 2015. And then Senator Udall hearing stories around that time, maybe a little after that, and making a promise that it would make a difference. Of course, nothing has happened. And how long is this now? 9 years. It hasn't made a difference. I mean, they haven't been helped. Nobody has been helped, although we are much, much, much closer to getting recognition, the downwinders, and compensation.
How and when in this process did you meet Tina Cordova?
I met Tina pretty early on. One of the other teams was doing a fundraiser at party, and Tina started speaking, telling her story to some of the guests. Actually, it was some of the actors from the TV program Manhattan, which then was canceled, unfortunately, because they were so moved that they promised that they would include stories of the downwinders in the next season. And then, unfortunately, it was canceled. So those stories weren't heard. But Tina was talking, and Tina always says that she looked at me and she just saw my face, and she saw how horrified I was and how she could see that I was really deeply moved. And she already knew that I'd worked for 60 Minutes and won an Emmy. And so she just reached out and she said, "Lois, will you make this film? Will you tell this story? Will you follow me?" She said, "I've been on this journey for 11 years, trying to get the attention of the media and members of Congress, trying to get justice and acknowledgement and some compensation. And I feel like I'm hitting my head against a wall. But if you make a film, you will amplify my voice and the story will be heard by a much, much, much wider audience." So I said yes, because this is so meaningful of a project. And also, Tina is such a hero, or a shiro. I mean, Tina has got the gravitas, she's got the weight, she's got the energy. Anybody who listens to Tina or hears Tina falls in love with Tina, admires Tina. So my whole goal then was to follow Tina. And as Tina put the pieces together, because the story got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And I've been filming it for so long that you even see Tina getting older, and you don't see me getting older, but if you were filming me, you would have. But that's great. And at the end, Tina says, "And what I've learned and how I've changed, you know," and great films usually enable you to see a story develop and to get realizations with time. And so we had that time. I mean, people that I brought in were Doug Blush. So I went to a little workshop for women in film in Oregon, a doc camp, and we all suddenly were asked to show 5 minutes of what we did. And at that point, I had filmed and edited 5 minutes of Tina, and I didn't know what to do with it. And people just burst in applause when they saw it. And this was maybe 8 years ago or 7 years ago. And so then I called Doug up and I said, "Doug, can I come visit you? I don't know what to do with this. Can you give me some guidance?" And so I went to LA. Did I say that Doug has won 4 Academy Awards? He's a great film editor and story person. And he just looked at my footage and Tina, and he said, "You have to make it feature film. But you have to make it at the very highest level, so that it gets noted, because you can't just tell a story. You have to make a great film if you want it to get national attention." And also, that costs a lot of money. I didn't know any of that. You know, I just said, "Okay, I will do it." You know, I'm very lucky that Doug's coming on board. And then I shot with some people. I did some more filming. Well, at a certain point, I realized I wasn't going to be filming except when I have to. I, you know, search for some really, really fine cinematographers who happened to be in New Mexico, who were wonderful. And we went all over traveling together. And then I really needed to work with a great editor. It was like 3 years before I finished this film, because I had a cut, but the cut was not good enough, you know, and I needed a partner, a great partner, and I was very lucky. I met a fantastic editor who became my co-producer. He's from London, but he lives in LA. His name is Joel Marcus. It was really funny. I initially was committed. I had to have a woman editor. This had to be a, you know, totally woman-made film. But I approached like 6 great women editors. And at that time, it was the golden age of documentaries. which is not now. And so they were all committed with Ceres. You know, they said, we'd love to do this, but we can't. And then my nephew, who's a filmmaker, said, why don't you meet Joel Marcus? I know he's passionate about social justice. And why don't you see if the two of you would like to work together? So I was in LA and I met Joel. And initially we thought it would be just 6 months. And I worked with him for 2.5 years. But, you know, I kept pushing to get more intimate, to get more beauty, to get more drama, to get better cinematography. We kept working and working on it and re-editing it. And then Doug would give us notes. And it was a real joy and so meaningful to work with Joel, to work with Doug, and to be invited into the community of the Downwinders and the uranium miners.
That was one thing that really struck me about the film. You used the word intimate a few times, and that's what I wrote as well, that there's this great intimacy, great immediacy, and people opened up to you at a truly profound level, sometimes in the immediate wake of a tragedy having befallen them just a few days before. And there's a tremendous amount of emotion that is brought to it from them that had me in tears periodically. How did you gain and maintain that level of trust with the people?
Well, thank you for saying that. Firstly, of course, I spent a long time there. I was not like a journalist that flies in and flies out. I was there for the long haul. The other hugely important thing is that Tina gave me her blessing. And if Tina tells the community to speak with Lois and trust Lois, they will do that. You know, I'm forever grateful to Tina and to everyone, but that just opened doors. And then I just showed up, you know, like I happened to be there and happened to be at a vigil and spoke with many people, but with Jenny Alexander. And it turned out she had just lost her third son 2 days earlier, you know, so you get luck when you're there on the ground and you're working on something that's substantial. Things will just, with time, unfold.
That was one of the most moving moments of the film because it was so raw and so real. Most of what is said, certainly by those in power about nuclear, is very abstract. It's very cold. It's very clinical. You got under the skin and you weren't dealing with the people in the cities. You were dealing with the people who were on the ground and there and had to live with this with complete parentheses around them. That revelation made the film extremely cohesive, extremely gentle in the telling. You weren't hitting us over the head with anything, which is how we got to be hit over the head with the truth of the story.
Thank you.
So, you talked about the fact that it was difficult to find financing for a film like this because it was very expensive. How did you do it?
Well, firstly, I did have great generosity from, it turned out, people that I knew in Santa Fe who knew me. And it turned out that they have, you know, they're philanthropists, and I didn't know that, but they believed in me. You know, they knew how much I cared and was how hard I was working at this. Anyway, I have great gratitude for the Gale Family Foundation. That was Marie and Ed. They gave me my first funding, significant funding that enabled me to get moving. And they, you know, topped it up quite a few times. I mean, I think I raised half of the money for the film. And in the end, there was such urgency to get this story out because it was being denied. And the Downwinders had a deadline that, you know, they needed to get to Congress. They needed this story out. And so I used a lot of my savings because I didn't want to wait till it was too late. But there were these remarkable stories, like when we screened at the Santa Fe International Film Festival. That was our first screening. That was at the end of last October. And two different young women who I know, and they knew me, but we weren't close friends, but they both stepped forward, each one of them, and said, I have money and I feel like I should spend it on something worthwhile. And they both gave significant amounts of money. And also, I have to thank the Santa Fe Film Institute, which is under the umbrella of the Santa Fe International Film Festival, and Jacques Paysner. And I was given their first ever grant. And it was a tiny grant. I mean, it was $600, right? But I had applied for so many grants. I had started out, oh, Lois, you'll get a Ford Foundation grant. You'll get a, you know, MacArthur, whatever. I was really shooting high because my stories were always recognized at 60 Minutes. And I didn't know this environment here. I mean, you have to be known. Anyways, for a long time, I wasted a lot of my precious time writing for grants that we didn't get. And then I got a grant from the Santa Fe Film Institute. And then I could proudly say in my next grant submissions, I have been funded by this Santa Fe Film Institute. And suddenly our film had this added credibility because funders are so scared to put money into something unless it's proven. And then, you know, somebody stepped forward, Denise Herrera, who was with Canalma Health, and she knows intimately how harmed the people here are, how sick they are. So she also awarded me two grants.
So you said the film premiered last October.
Yep.
What was the response?
Oh my God. Unbelievable. It kept selling out. You know, we were at the Santa Fe International Film Festival and everybody wanted to see it. They added two or three additional screenings. I think it screened four or five times. It won the Audience Award. It won Best New Mexico. There was a buzz because this is a story that nobody's seen and the story needs to be told. People wanted to see it. It was so exciting, you know, because I'd worked solitary and it's just extraordinary to then bring it to the public and have it touch people as this story has touched me. So then the next week, we screened at the Austin Film Festival, which is a great film festival. And we were honored to be awarded the best documentary of the festival. And that gave our film momentum. You know, these new words I'm learning. You have to have momentum. You have to win awards. This is how it happens. And I'm like, oh, okay. I'm glad to know I have to win awards. So I'll try, you know. But then after that, we were invited to screen in Palm Springs. And that's a big festival. It's nearer to LA. Again, it was an honor because David Anson, who was the renowned film critic at Newsweek, and for years I really looked up to him and his writing, and now he's a curator at Palm Springs. He shepherded my film there. And at the end of the screening, we were walking to the front to do the Q&A, and I was in a daze. And then David said to me, I've never seen a standing ovation here before. And then I saw that everybody was standing and applauding. It was incredible. And that happened at two screenings, and then they added a third screening as a best of festival. And then it was at Santa Barbara. And then we've been all over the place, but it costs money to do that. You know, we're not funded for that. And it's so critically important that our film is seen by people. It's making a difference. People don't know this story. And every time they see the film, people are weeping. They're saying they're shocked. They're saying, how could I not know this? What can I do to help? So I just feel an urgency to keep traveling with Tina, traveling with Paul Pino, traveling with the Downwinders, traveling with the uranium miners, the native uranium miners, which we did a few weeks ago in Flagstaff, and we won the grand jury award there. But there were 10 miners and downwinders who were there. And when their presence is seen, my God, it's just incredible. Until we get to another level of recognition.
Right now, one could say that you are in the belly of the beast. You have been showing both last week and this week coming up. There's still some screening set for the Oppenheimer Festival in Los Alamos. What has it been like for you to go to Los Alamos with this, you should pardon the expression, bombshell of a movie and have it be shown to people who were right there where it all began.
It was so moving. It was extraordinary. Senator Jaramillo, he was the first person to speak. I didn't know him. I didn't know what he would say. And then I looked and I saw that he had a whole career at Los Alamos before he's retired. And he was from Hispaniola, which is not so far, it was very close, but it's very Hispanic and poor. He was the first person to speak. And he said that he's 15 generation on that land. And the legacy of cancer that he and his people have seen since Trinity is indescribable. So he had such empathy and power in his voice. But then all these people spoke with us afterwards. The mayor, who is the owner of the Los Alamos newspaper, and she's the dedicated journalist there, she said, "I am reeling. I have not recovered. I will do everything in my power to get people to see the film, to know about the screenings and come." So, I mean, there were definitely lab people there. We invited the top people. They were not at the screening. And I hope they do get to see the film or choose to see the film. But the mood in that room was every room where we screened, people were, they cared so deeply. They were so moved by the story and they were so moved by the heroes in the story. And Tina spoke, and Mariah Gomez, Professor Mariah Gomez, whose family were, they lost their land to build the lab. She was the moderator. And then we had Dr. Arlene Brown, whose story is incredible. She grew up in Los Alamos and her dad worked on the bomb with Oppenheimer. Then after that, he was sent by the Manhattan Project to Japan later on. And he observed that after the explosion, people there were suffering from radiation poisoning. He came back and he spoke to the top people. He said, "I'm very, very concerned. We just did a test in New Mexico. We need to look at the people in New Mexico. They must be suffering from radiation poisoning. We need to help them and study them." And they said, "Oh, that's okay. We're taking care of it. We're taking care of it." So that was Dr. Brown. And her mother died of radiation poisoning, breast cancer caused by the labs. But then Dr. Brown became a doctor, and she's very selfless, and she dedicated her life to being a doctor in southern New Mexico. And she was a doctor for over 40 years, and she knew the stories more than anybody. And she traveled. She was based in Ruidosa, but she traveled to the Pueblo. She traveled to these small towns. I had a very, very hard time getting a doctor to speak. Nobody would speak with me. And, you know, this is a lab city. This is a lab industry. This is a multi-billion dollar industry in an impoverished state of New Mexico. When we were virtually done with the film, but I said to Joel, my co-producer editor, I said, "Joel, I don't have a doctor yet." He said, "Call up Dr. Brown again. See if she's changed her mind." So I called her and she said, "Yeah, sure, I'll do an interview." And I'm like, "Let's get there now, you know?" So we did an interview with her. I was holding my breath. And her stories were just extraordinary. And at the end of it, I said, "Dr. Brown, why did you change your mind? Why have you decided to give us an interview?" And she said, "Well, I just retired. Hopefully they can't get at me now."
You also included information about the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act and the push for it. And you showed footage that you shot in DC of the lobbying. What I was really interested in, and you managed to catch it at the very last moment, was the addenda saying that RECA, the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, which was supposed to give funding to those who were harmed by our weapons program, by our nuclear programs, had expired on June 4th of 2024, and that the battle was going to continue. You managed to get those like slides at the very end. So that was not in the film when it was screened last October, because it had not happened yet.
I had to open up the film, and we did that 2 weeks ago.
Wow. And I know that that is also an additional expense.
It is.
And
It's many thousands of dollars.
I live in Hollywood. I worked in the industry myself, so I'm very
Oh.
familiar with what these kind of things cost and how difficult it can be, which is what makes your achievement with this film to do something so large and important, but do it on such an intimate scale, on such a human scale. I think that was the most moving part of it for me. You just paid attention to the people who were on the ground, whose families were on the ground, who had been harmed, and who nobody would listen to, and gave us insights into the way they live their lives and where and how and what their beliefs are and how they come together as community in very small ways that are very powerful and very meaningful. It was a real glimpse into a community.
Thank you so much for saying that. Joel and I spent a lot of time talking about that before we started editing the film, and it was so important. These people had been written off like nobody lived there. And I wanted to show their life, the texture, the quality of their life, their celebrations, their music, their food, their dancing. I wanted people to fall in love with these people as I had, so they can't be written off. You know, we were very clear. We weren't going to do, I mean, I very much admire 60 Minutes, et cetera. We weren't going to do that sort of story. We weren't going to have the experts come in and out like that. It was going to be like a beautiful narrative film. But we needed to have experts because to just have the downwinders, their story could be discounted. Oh, well, how can you prove any of this? You know, they can say whatever they want. They're looking for money. I mean, all this, you know, BS, right? And so I put a lot of effort into finding really incredible, very knowledgeable, passionate experts like Kate Brown, who is at MIT. And she blew the lid on Chernobyl when they were saying 32 people had died. And she spoke all these Slavic languages and went into files and came out with thousands of deaths. And Dr. Luis Campos, but we had to be so careful in how we wove them in so it wasn't heavy with experts. They just came on to give some support to the story of the Downwinders.
So you're in the middle of the Oppenheimer Festival as we speak. When are the next screenings there, if there are still some on the schedule? And beyond that, where else are you scheduled to appear?
So the screenings are through the month of August. So I think it'll be just one more weekend. I think it's Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, I believe. And the screenings are all around, they're either at 6 o'clock or 5:30. They vary, but you can just go on the Oppenheimer Film Festival website to see when those screenings are. And then we are going to be at the United Nations Film Festival.
That's the one in October, isn't it?
And it's also associated with some extraordinary woman who teaches at Stanford, and she started it. We're going to be at Gig Harbor in Washington State and Alabama, and I can't remember all the places we're going. I mean, my focus now is reaching out to distributors rather than, that's what Jacques said to me. He said, Lois, you've won so many awards and you've been at a lot of festivals, and I love going to festivals. Oh, we're going to be at Breckenridge very soon in a few weeks, and we haven't been to Colorado yet. And Colorado is part of this, they were harmed too from the nuclear exposure. In fact, that is something, Libby, I'm going to do, which is to go back to Film Freeway and identify film festivals in these states that have been radiated, where people are dying. The Republicans, ironically, hold the majority there, and they're not in favor of compensation. So we will bring the film, that's my mission, and Tina's, to bring the film to these states like Nevada and Utah and invite people to hear the people speak. Because It's a win-win for everybody. You know, it would bring money into the states. People would be able to afford medical treatment. And the members of Congress who are against RICA got to change their mind. They've got to become educated and they've got to change their mind. It's a win-win for everybody. So like we did screen at Doc Utah in St. George, where they were heavily radiated. And the uranium miners went there. They just rented a van and they all came, and Tina and all these downwinders. It was the most moving to hear the stories of the experience of the people in St. George and how they've been harmed by the Nevada Cold War tests and what, you know, they're suffering, and to have a community. And we were awarded Activism and Film Award there, but we want to continue doing that.
If people wish to view the film or perhaps purchase a copy of it, is there a way that they can do so? And if so, what is that?
Not yet. It'll have to be on a streamer. And we hope it'll have to be on a POV or PBS. And, you know, we hope that that happens soon. And I'll certainly let you know when it does.
Is there anything we haven't touched upon that you would like to share with the listeners at this time?
My dream, my goal is like to find philanthropists or streamer who really gets behind this film as we are and puts it up for an Academy Award campaign, because there's no more important story than this one. I mean, the labs are just about to start making more sophisticated plutonium pits. We have never heard the world's nuclear origin story, the consequences. And yes, it's another generation. We can't hold these people responsible, but we can look clearly and hear these stories and try to make well, you know, try to do good about it, acknowledge what happened and not make the same mistakes. And then we're looking for celebrities. If there's celebrities who see the film and they love it, they would elevate, they would put the film in a much higher spotlight. And that's what we want, because as the Santa Fe New Mexican said, if we could just lock all the legislators up in a room and force them to see First We Bomb New Mexico, RICA would be expanded in a heartbeat.
And that's the goal for all of us, and definitely is supported tremendously, deeply, emotionally, and profoundly by your film, First We Bombed New Mexico.
Thank you.
Lois Lipman, I want to thank you for the work you did in pulling this film together and for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you so much. It's a joy to, and an honor to be on your program.
That was Lois Lipman, filmmaker of First We Bombed New Mexico. We'll have a link up to her website, firstwebombednewmexico.com, where you can learn all the latest about screenings and the availability of the film.
Activists, shout out.
If you're in Los Angeles, mark your calendars for December 7th and 8th, because that's when the Atomic Age Cinema Fest returns to Hollywood. Atomic Age Cinema Fest is the name that is being used for a collaboration that's co-presenting the films, Kat Kramer's Films That Changed the World and the International Uranium Film Festival. The lineup is still being firmed up, but more than half a dozen films will be screened during that time, and there will also be a panel discussion involving some of Hollywood's movers and shakers. The first Atomic Age Cinema Fest took place in 2016 at the Raleigh Studios in Hollywood, with stars such as Isai Morales, Lou Gossett Jr., Ed Asner, Kat Kramer, and Harvey Wasserman on a panel discussion. Note that Kat Kramer is the daughter of director Stanley Kramer, who made the film On the Beach, which is one of the films that will be screened this year. We'll have further updates as the time goes by, but remember, December 7th and 8th in Los Angeles. I hope to see you there. More film news. The Nuclear Free Team of the Sierra Club's Grassroots Network invites you to join a screening in their Nuclear Free Film Series. It will be Atomic Bamboozle and available during the month of September. We'll have a link to it up on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 688. On Monday, September 30th, there will be a supporting webinar from 5 to 7 p.m. Pacific Time with panelists including the filmmaker Jan Hocken, associate producer Kathy Simpson Cruz, M.V. Ramana, Mark Z. Jacobson, and David Schlissel. The panel will be moderated by Nuclear Free Team co-chair Mike Carberry. If you are in Ohio, in the Piketon-Portsmouth area, on Saturday, September 14, at the Career Technology Center in Piketon, reporter Dwayne Poolman from Local 12 News, who has been so terrific about covering the issues around the Portsmouth Gaseous Diffusion Plant, will be doing interviews for people who have or had cancer or other related illnesses who have been living near or working at the Portsmouth Gaseous Diffusion Plant. We'll have a contact to Gina Doyle, the organizer, on the website, nuclearhotseat.com. And again, that will take place on Saturday, September 14, from 1 to 4, at the Career Technology Center in Piketon, Ohio. On August 17, a webinar was held, Don't Nuke the Pacific, Protect Our Ocean, which was co-organized by groups from the Pacific, Japan, and the United Nations. Now, the Manhattan Project for a Nuclear-Free World has helped get it up on YouTube, and it is available for you to watch. We'll have a link to it up on the website, nuclearhotseat.com. This episode is number 688. And we will also have a link to a really interesting and important article, Digital Activism, Do's and Don'ts to Keep Yourself Safe Online. As we're probably aware, the threat of online harassment, surveillance, and doxing is ever-present and can cause significant mental and physical harm, prompting many young activists to reconsider the ways they use and experience social media. This is a really savvy document, and if you have any interest, we'll have that link up on the website as well. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, August 27, 2024. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, we make it so easy. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com. You cannot miss the big yellow opt-in box that will pop up. Simply put in your first name and email, and once a week, just once, you will get an email from us with a link to that week's show and a brief summary of some of the material that's in it. You can also, if you listen to podcasts regularly, go to your favorite podcast channel because you can find us there. We are everywhere. And we rely on you to help us with this show. If you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really and always need your help. Anything at all, and we will appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2024, Libby Halevi, Hartestry Communications, and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, and if you can get it in, the names of any guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you that efforts by the media, corporate interests, and the government to minimize the impact of nuclear radiation on our lives and health doesn't change the scientific facts. It just keeps us trapped in a danger that we can't escape because we don't know the truth about it. There you have it. You have just had your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.